So on to what I want to talk about. Tell me about your particular visual impairment. What's the nature of it?
Right. Mm-hmm. I have what's called retinitis pigmentosa, RP. It's a hereditary condition, although nobody in my family has ever had it. I'm an isolated case. And I got it. I discovered that I had it when I was in college. I was in school for industrial design. At that time, I didn't think much of it. I mean, what led me to discover that I had it was I was starting to miss things. I would like walk around the corner and like bump into a parking meter or something, and I'd stand back and look at it, and I would say, "How could I miss that? I could see it. I mean, why? I don't understand." What I didn't understand at that time, of course, was that something like a parking meter, which was below my regular line of sight, was in a blind spot. Was in a blind spot where two areas of blind spots each eye has certain blind spots. And in this case, a parking meter that I was walking toward would be in an area where those two blind spots overlap, and it's a true blind spot that you can't see with either eye. Sometimes if you have a blind spot that's sort of like, for me, it was kind of like a donut shape of blind spot in each eye.
Okay.
But what you don't see with one eye, you see with the other, because the two don't necessarily correspond. So you can have blind spots in both eyes, but you just, it's not that you even consciously compensate for it. You just, your eyes happen to see, one happens to see what the other doesn't. So you would never know unless you sat there, covered one eye, and tried to, you know, do a sort of a field test and measure it and say, "Oh my gosh, I don't see that," you know. And that was the case with me. I didn't know. And so after a few of these kind of episodes where I would like miss things or bump into things, I went to an eye doctor, and they did a bunch of tests and, you know, field tests and all this kind of stuff. And they said, "Well, you know, you are legally blind." And I said, "What?" I didn't understand what that even meant. And they explained it to me, and I was stunned. I mean, it made sense, but it's a weird kind of thing to hear from a doctor, you know, because what I was directly looking at, I could still pretty much see with corrective lenses. But then they demonstrated to me, "Well, you see how, you know, if you cover this eye, look at this graph, and do you notice that you can't, if you look straight ahead, if you look straight at the center of this graph, do you notice that you can't see the lines to the left?" And I was again stunned. I go, "Oh my gosh, you're right." With the other eye closed, I could not see it, but if I opened both eyes, I could see all of the lines.
Gotcha.
So that's how I found out, and that was a long time ago. And RP is a kind of condition that it affects different people in different ways. Some people lose their sight very quickly. Some people have a very long tail, and other people it's just anywhere in the middle. And I guess for me, it's I guess it's a long tail because, you know, I was diagnosed back in '85. So it's been quite a long time. I still do have usable vision, but usable in the sense that, I mean, light detection and stuff like that. I don't read standard print of any sort. That's long gone. I can't read any standard print. I don't recognize people by their appearance or anything like that. So I do have usable vision, but I'm definitely considered legally blind because I have no measurable vision. Measurable in the sense that, like, there's no chart that would contain any kind of sizable letter that, you know, that I would be able to really read from any, you know, significant distance, you know. Again, nothing meaningful. So there's just no measurable vision.
Gotcha. As you work through, I thought we'd maybe talk about basic you know, tracking and mixing and what you use and how you deal with that lack of vision in the various stages.
Right. Right.
In you know, setting up mics, placing mics, tracking stages, you know, one of my big questions was how do you handle metering?
Right. Right. Okay. So let me just say that when I decided to, I had always been involved in, music first of all, but audio specifically. I had been involved with it before I was diagnosed as being legally blind. So early on, you know, I mean, I was doing recordings, whether it was like on just a two-track reel-to-reel or even like a little, you know, multi-track, you know, cassette format or something like Porta Studio or whatever. That was at a time when I still had a quite usable vision. So in my initial learning experience, I did that as a, you know, as a sighted person.
Okay.
Then came that time when I was diagnosed with this condition and blah, blah, blah. And then there were a number of years that I didn't, well, I couldn't finish school for industrial design. It got really difficult. You know, I say that I have a long tail in terms of the decrease of vision, but by the time I was diagnosed, being legally blind, it was pretty difficult to read, and I kind of lost that. It was very difficult kind of early on. So I didn't know what I was going to do, and a few years had gone by when I decided I was going to go back to school and I was going to go for audio recording technology. I figured, let me, you know, if I'm going to pursue some other career other than industrial design, let it be at least something that I'm quite interested in and I have some experience in. And when I went back to school, and I went for this degree, I went to Five Towns College and enrolled in the jazz commercial music department where the concentration was audio recording technology. You know, the stuff that I did then, I had to, if there was any sort of instruction about mic placement or anything like that, even though to me I had in what my mind was, you know, experience in this, you know, in those areas, I did always ask the teacher, you know, if I could, let's say, stay for a few minutes afterwards and just ask to, you know, get up close to what the teacher was demonstrating so that I could actually get my hands on that microphone relative to the piano, relative to that instrument, whatever it was, just so that I was on the same page, because I could assume all I wanted, but unless I really got up close and right up there, I wouldn't know for sure. So,
okay.
So as far as, you know, microphone techniques and all that kind of stuff, that was something that I did, you know, work with my teachers specifically to make sure that I was understanding stuff the right way. And, you know, for the most part, we were on the same page, and my assumptions were correct. But there were a few surprises, I'm sure, along the way where I go, oh, okay, now I see what you mean, because, you know, the terminology may be one thing, and then, you know, you might, you know, not seeing it, of course, a picture's worth a thousand words, and not seeing something sometimes would be, you could easily misunderstand.
Sure thing.
When it came to metering at that time with some usable vision, what I tended to do, and it was around that time that I started working out of home. You know, I basically had a home studio or whatever, but then eventually moved it out of my home into a dedicated space. At that time, I was using a 16-track, an analog machine, and I used a little magnifier, something about 3 inches, you know, 3.5 inches or whatever across. And I would put that right up to a VU meter, you know, if I was calibrating a machine or whatever. That was pretty easy. Because normally, I mean, when setting up a machine, it's not like the needle was flying all over the place. It's stationary when you put MRL tapes on, you know, so that was very doable. When it came to tracking though, I would not be, it was just not practical for me to sit there and try to track a moving meter. So what I would do typically is, I would, if I were doing, say, drum tracks, you know, I would keep an eye on the peak indicator. That I could pretty much see, well, first of all, it's one point of focus, so I could easily just focus on that point. And if I was, you know, doing kick and snare or whatever, I'd take the level up until I saw that we were about to peak. I just backed it off a bit, and you know, you estimate, I guess, in
okay.
that sense. Plus, the machines were over biased anyway, so I was using 499, so I was a +9 tape. So I didn't even have to come close to hitting the peak. It was already, you know, getting nice hot levels, you know. But also the console that I was using did have LED meters. So in that case, it was an 8-bus console, even though it had direct outs and stuff like that. I could meter any of the direct outs, but it essentially had LED meters, which were, as I recall, you know, green, yellow, and red,
mm-hmm.
where I could get a sense, even though I was pretty much at that point, just, I would say probably just about colorblind, I could get a sense where the meters changed from, you know, a particular intensity to another intensity. Even if I couldn't tell what color it was, the hue was different enough that I could actually pretty much make out, you know, that difference. And besides, it's not even just the change in color, but just, you know, you get used to seeing
how many bars are there.
You know, how many bars are there? Exactly. It's a certain height. You just get used to the metrics, the dimension, rather than the color. Very similar to like a VU. You know, you kind of get a sense where it is. You know, 1 o'clock, 1:30 position. You're pretty good. You know, so I did that for a long time, and at a certain point, you know, of course, with the advent of you know, digital audio workstations and stuff like that, I got to a point where I had to move on. I had to make a jump because my machine, I had an Otari MX-70. It was getting old. You know, I had bought it used, but it was in excellent condition when I did buy it originally. But I think at that point it was probably already, to, you know, I don't know, 15 years old. Who knows? I could have, and who knows? It could have been more. I'm not sure. Maybe even 20 years old. But I had a technician that took care of it on a regular basis. But I just started noticing, of course, that, you know, parts would break down more often. And my technician was very, you know, good about stopping by when I needed them to, but sometimes I'd be without two channels on my, you know, machine, you know, for a couple of days, and that was a problem. It became a problem. One time the machine just literally, a client said to me, your machine is smoking. I said, oh, man. I was like, yeah, you know, turned everything off, stopped it, made sure that, you know, nothing, you know, just it was some parts just melted down, you know, and I had to wait, I think, 2 months to get parts from Japan for it, you know, so it just, I realized I really need to consider my options. It was right around that time that Pro Tools HD came out. And I, you know, I, long story short, I spoke with a few people about it. I had a listen to the system, and I thought it sounded pretty good. I thought it sounded pretty good to my ear, as compared with what I was used to. And my concern was metering, okay? Because in an analog domain, I knew that I had a lot of leeway, and it was very forgiving. I could monitor off the playback head. It was a non-issue. In the digital domain, of course, having worked with, you know, DAWs in school and stuff like that, I understood, of course, that full-scale metering, you know, was like, it was a scary thing. I could not reach zero. But at that time, the idea was to use as many bits as you can, you know, and
yeah.
a lot of it was still even 16-bit or 20-bit, you know. 24-bit was kind of new then. And so it concerned me. And now, I spoke with... regarding Pro Tools accessibility, there's a guy by the name of Rick Boggs who, back in the early 90s, was trying to use Pro Tools, and he was using a screen reader. He's totally blind. He was using this screen reader called Outspoken, and he tried to run Pro Tools with it. He's a musician, and he was, you know, trying to do some recording, whatever.
Was that still OS 9?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And actually, I think it might have even been OS 8 at the time, but certainly OS 9, definitely, as well. And he found that when he had Outspoken running and Pro Tools running, the system would hang. It would just crash. And, you know, without Outspoken running, it worked fine, you know. So he was at a trade show once and approached the two, you know, well, went to DigiDesign at the time and said, you know, I he explained the situation, and they were like, we don't know why that would be. You know, it's probably a problem with the thing, with the screen reader, and like. They didn't seem interested in helping. He says, oh, well, okay, well, you know, the guys at eMagic said that they would look into it, and maybe I'll just, you know, switch platforms. Well, wait a second. Well, you know, we could take a look at it. I mean, you know, it wouldn't hurt to, you know, take a look at it. And sure enough, they got together with the makers of Outspoken, and they found out that it was an incompatibility with the DAE, DigiDesign Audio Engine,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the system init. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Mac side of things, are you?
I am. I remember all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so it was a system init, you know, so they changed a little bit of their code, and suddenly Outspoken worked fine, and the thing was, the way the program was written, all kinds of things were visible to the screen reader. You know, there are things like, for example, in the mix window, you know, the screen reader would see show/hide, you know, which see that little pop-up button for the track list.
Mm-hmm.
But then it would say symbol, 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 symbol if you read to the right. Well, you know, he discovered that those were inserts. So if you name one of them, then after that, it says insert, 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 going all the way across. And, you know, you go down to the next row, it's still more inserts. And then at a certain point, you get to another item. It's a symbol. Well, that's different. So the dictionary in the screen reader sees that symbol as something different. So it doesn't call it insert. So now what's that? Oh, somebody tells them it's a send. Okay, well, you label it send. Now you have send, 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 send going across. And if you click on it, of course, it brings up the pop-up menu, and screen reader has no trouble reading, you know, no send, interface, submenu, bus, submenu, whatever. You know, you could go in there and assign things. So then after that, you see send bus 1-2. Then send, 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 send. So in other words, you get a sort of an idea of a you know, the representation of what's going on there. You have this insert, and then you have the text that, if you've assigned it to something, it says bus 1-2 or whatever.
Did you have to do that training of the screen reader as to what each of those symbols was defined as for every system? Or once that was done once, could you pass that around
as
a preference file?
One could do that, yes. And the thing is, I'm trying to recall at this point, I'm not sure whether Rick had ever sent me a copy of his Outspoken preferences, the screen reader's preference file. He might not have. I don't recall. I think at that time, I was just starting to get into the screen reader world. I had used screen enlarging software. So when I first learned Pro Tools, it was with screen magnification. Same company made a product called Enlarge. And I was able to zoom up to 16 times magnification on screen, and I could actually see those icons, you know, the inserts or the sends. Now, I wasn't a big Pro Tools user really at that time. I used Digital Performer, but I did the same thing with Digital Performer. I zoomed way in on the screen, and I was able to see the little triangles. If they were solid red, I could see that was, you know, record enabled. You know, I could see the assignments, whether it was assigned to a particular MIDI channel, a particular device, a particular channel, et cetera, et cetera. If a track was highlighted, I could see these little, you know, sub menus in their little, you know, in the editor windows and stuff. And so when I first started using Pro Tools, I actually, you know, started the very first time just with the screen enlarging program. But then I found that, gosh, you know, things, I actually wondered to myself, gee, I wonder if a screen reader would be just more efficient. You know, it's one thing that, you know, you'll often find with people who are visually impaired as opposed to totally blind, is, you know, they try to use what they have, and let's face it, you know, if you can use it, use it. It makes sense. But I started to think at that time, gee, I wonder, you know, if screen reader is really the way to go because it might be easier. Well, I gave it a shot. I tried it. I was a beta tester for Outspoken. But at that time, when I was beta testing back in, I don't know, 88 or something like that, Outspoken was quite unstable, I thought. And I just gave up on it. I beta tested for a little while, but then I just stopped using it. I thought it wasn't very good. Well, by this point in the sort of mid to late 90s, yeah, late 90s, probably about 10 years later, the screen reader had come a long way, and Rick assured me that, you know, oh no, it'll work. You know, it works really well. It works with Pro Tools. You know, that was my concern. So I gave it a try, and I was really, really quite pleasantly surprised to see that I could do things so much faster and so much more efficiently with the screen reader. I could find elements on the screen very quickly just by hitting a find button, typing the first couple of letters of the name, and, you know, hitting return, and boom, I'm on the record button. I'm on the first instance of the record button. You know, like there might be three record buttons. If I hit the find button, type REC, hit return, I'm on the first one. If I hit that find button again and hit return, it'll go to the next one. And then two keystrokes later, I'm on the third one. It's pretty, you know, pretty quick, instead of what I was used to, sort of zooming in and kind of like moving the mouse over and trying to see, oh, there's the other button and there's the third button. For, you know, it's just totally inefficient.
When you moved from magnification to the screen reader, does that also mean basically doing away with the mouse at that point and everything's just keystrokes?
Yes, pretty much. There came a time later where under OS X, where the mouse sort of became important again, but under OS 9, I found that I was really working a lot more efficiently, and there was still the issue of the metering. Like in Pro Tools, of course, there was there were the meters, but there was no real way, you know, they were dynamic, they were always changing. There was no way for a screen reader to communicate what those meters were doing, you know. occasionally it was possible to, it would notice that there would be a symbol there, but that symbol would change because, you know, it's like an LED being on and off. And it was sort of impractical to sort of try and position the cursor, the mouse pointer, over an LED that, let's say, you wanted to know whether that was peaking or not. It didn't, you just could not get it to work in any real way. But as I understood, and I remembered that there was a volume indicator in terms of, it said, you know, VOL, and then it would give you 0.0, or if it was, you know, minus 2 dB, it would say minus 2.0. And if you command clicked that display, it would change to a peak value, uh-huh. which you had to click on it to reset it, but it would tell you the last achieved value, and then if you did it again, of course, it was the delay value or whatever. And Rick had mentioned to me, yeah, but for some reason the dictionary does not, you can't name that. It just sees it as symbol, 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 just like those inserts and sends. But it's, you know, he says, like, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be possible. So what he did was, you know, he just basically kind of got used to keeping his preamps that he was using at a certain level. He kind of, you know, got in the ballpark, and then he used a Waves plugin, what was it called, a tracker or something. It's basically a limiter plugin, but that really did thing for the incoming signal. So what he had to do is he had to route his track to another track through the plugin. So he's like, right, in real time recording. Let me just get rid of this call. 1 second, Jeff. So I thought, geez, I really don't understand why it's not possible to rename those symbols. And I experimented a little bit. And by the way, at this point, you know, sort of like early 2000, somewhere 2001, I don't know, in that range, there were a few blind Pro Tools users, a handful, probably, I don't know, six, eight, ten, I don't know, in that range of numbers, a small number of people. And they were all just kind of doing the same thing, you know, kind of experimenting, and the whole metering thing, or, you know, checking levels was a tough part of it, you know. And so what I did was, it occurred to me, and I realized that one of the things that was happening with the screen reader was that sometimes it could get distracted. Like if you, for example, if you had a clock in your menu bar, the fact that the colon was flashing between the numbers, mm-hmm. you know, for seconds to yeah. to whatever. Sometimes the screen reader would be distracted by that, and like if you tried to query the state of something or the color or the text or whatever, it would lose focus very quickly. And, you know, you'd have to refocus on an item or whatever. And the thought occurred to me, I wonder if that's happening in Pro Tools. And as it turns out, that apparently was exactly the case. If you were trying to label something like, the volume images, which were, you know, minus 0 through 9, decimal point, 0 through 9, or whatever, or infinity, you know, there was another sign, or delta. If you had the edit window open in the background and you had an insertion point, the screen reader would always be distracted by that. So what I did was...
the blinking cursor in the insertion point.
It's a blinking cursor. So it thinks it's supposed to be aware of that and ready to tell you what's there, which nothing was there. It was a waveform. It's not like it could tell you a letter or a number or anything like that. So I closed the edit window, and then so the only window I had open was the mix window. I go to the volume. It said VOL symbol. Well, let me see. If I had a control surface at this point, I knew that if I put that, if I, if I, if I were to set it to its default value, with, you know, hitting the default button and pressing the select button, it would absolutely categorically go to 0.0. So the, you know, and I had three symbols there before the next word VOL. So I went to the first symbol and I brought up the dictionary. It actually did come up, which in the past it never did come up, came up, and I said, okay, you know, this symbol now known as, and I typed the word zero, hit return. Well, now suddenly it was zero, symbol zero, volume zero, symbol zero. I thought, okay, well, that middle symbol has to be a decimal or point. I called it point. Labeled that. Now everything said volume 0.0, 0.0. So I changed, well, what I did at that point was I brought the, I just nudged that fader just ever so slightly so that it went to, you know, to another thing. And sure enough, it changed from 0.0 to symbol point symbol. You know, so now I knew, okay, well, what I did was, since I had a bigger range of numbers by moving upwards, I moved upwards, named the first symbol, you know, one, and then I moved a little bit, named that symbol two, three, and then I worked my way down. And so, you know, it went minus one, minus two, minus three, and then the next one, minus four. And I did that from one through nine, and then suddenly, if I changed to... If I command clicked on that thing, changed it to a PK value, well, now Pro Tools told me what I reached. So if, you know, it would say, you know, minus 2.5, I knew I was 2.5 dB away from zero full scale. So when I told people this, like, they could not believe that, you know, for years they had been using, you know, they had been, you know, some of them, a couple of them had been using Pro Tools since like 96, you know. And here, like, you know, 5 years later, you know, I come along and I go, yeah, you can label this after all, you know. So that, like, changed the world for these guys, because now they can feel confident about their metering. Even though at that time, like, again, around that time, you know, well, they had the Mix Plus systems and the cubed systems. I mean, we were already at 24 bits, so... You know, we really did not need to be achieving levels so close to zero anyway. But yeah, again, there was a lot of myths surrounding, you know, levels. I mean, to this, well, I don't say to this day. I think to this day, people do it. They wrongly assume that they need to record really close to zero.
They think they're not using all the bits if they don't.
Yeah, and. And so, but anyway, but back then that was really big. And so I, at that point, I felt confident enough that, you know, that I made that jump to Pro Tools HD, and I took basically a year off, so that I could learn Pro Tools like the back of my hand, you know, because I was used to working with, you know, with an analog console. I had a 32 channel, an old Allen and Heath console, and I had the multi-track. It was, you know, everything was very physical, very tactile, you know. And I needed to get to the point where I could move around the system and do what I needed to do quickly, because I can't sit there and kind of scratch my head with a client sitting next to me. I had to be able to do it, you know, really well. And so I read the Pro Tools reference guide. I mean, at that time, right now it's 1,250 pages. At that time, I think it was about 1,000 pages. I read it three times through, in addition to the other, you know, menus guides and getting started guides and all those kinds of things. The first time I read it, you know, was just simply to familiarize myself in general with Pro Tools at that level. The second time I read through, well, there's a lot of stuff the first time that I go, wow, I don't get it. This was not my world. I came from a totally analog world. The idea of the process, the workflow was just foreign to me at that time. I knew a little bit about Pro Tools because I did stuff in school, but at that point, you know, it was Pro Tools, but it was pretty much like Sound Tools.
Yeah.
It was still just a two-track editor, you know. So I can understand non-destructive editing, but, you know, this, you know, the whole inserts and sends and the way that worked was different from what I was used to.
And did you have a control service right from the beginning?
At the yes, I did. I did. I got the Control 24, which I still have to this day. It's, you know, the 24-channel, you know, control surface that DigiDesign put out, that Focusrite did for them.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, that made all the difference in the world to me, to have the moving faders, to have the encoder knobs available. Yeah, that really made a huge difference for me. Plus, at that time, there were certain key commands that were only available in HD. Nowadays, you know, a lot of people sort of just getting into Pro Tools take it for granted that, you know, if you hit the A button, it will trim from the insertion point to the beginning of the region. S would do the opposite, trim to the end of the region. That D would fade to the beginning, G would fade to the end.
Right.
All those things, changing from insertion following playback to not following playback with the N key.
Oh, I hate that one.
Well,
when I hit it by accident.
but to have that as a keyboard shortcut was a huge thing for me. To be able to toggle, you know, and that was not available in LE at that time. So, I mean, that was another reason. It was a fringe benefit of going for the HD version because there was a little bit better accessibility. Plus, you know, also in terms of the control surface, fader flip mode was the huge advantage because If I brought up a plugin, let's say an EQ plugin, I could spin encoder knobs all day. They're continuous. Now I might hear the effect, yeah, but what if it's a very subtle thing? You know, like I would have to spin a few knobs, maybe spin the wrong ones before I got to the right one. Well, now I've changed settings on the things that I didn't mean to. You know, stuff like that is problematic. It is problematic to this day for people. But with fader flip mode, you know, well, suddenly, you know, your faders are your tactile representation of stuff. So now, you know, and the way that, at least with the Control 24, you know, let's say the first fader is your input level, you know, well, that's all the way up by default. The next two faders are like blank, so they're all the way down. If you move them, they will just push back, right back down to the, you know, the lowest position. So, you know, you move your fingers across those first, you know, those first three faders, you know exactly where you are. The next fader is up. You know that that's your, you know, your high shelf boost and cut, you know. I mean, you don't know that, obviously, I should say, you don't know that if you've never used the program before, but if you know some other users or you sit down with someone sighted and you go, okay, I'm just trying to understand this, you know, they tell you that, okay, yeah, well, if your first thing is your high shelf, then you have your upper mids, your lower mids, and then your low shelf. And then once you know that, you're always going to know that, you know. I mean, especially if it's something that you use every day. If you're
sure.
a hobbyist, you know, yeah, you'll forget that fact. So
does that fader flip mode work in all plugins that you can assign the parameters down on the faders? I have a console that supports the Mackie interface, the HUI. So it only does
right, the Huey, right?
Yeah, only does faders and sends. It doesn't do plug-in parameters.
Oh, really? Even under the Huey protocol?
Maybe
really?
It doesn't. I don't know.
Wow. Well, because the thing was that way back when Rick was using it, he was a big proponent of using control surfaces because one thing about, you know, Pro Tools and OS 9 was that a quirk was that just the way it was drawn, the faders were not seen. You could read the value of the fader, but you could not find that fader with the screen reader on screen because it was just this strange combination of graphics that you could not get to it. You needed a control surface. You had to have a control surface in order to be able to change the level. Now, you could change a static level, like you could go into the track output window, select main output, and then double click on the value and type a value in and say -6, and your fader would suddenly pop down to -6 dB. But you know, you can't be expected to do a mix that way. Oh. It's all static, right? So you had to have a control surface to effectively use Pro Tools. If you wanted to pan stuff, you really needed to just grab a knob and pan, you know, rather than trying to, you know, to going into that output window, into the pan send window, and then type in a value. So with the faders, I mean, you know, he was using a JL Cooper, what was it called? The 30 MSC or whatever. It was 3500, I think was the number of that, the control surface. And it had fader flip mode, and it used the Huey protocol. Of course, there was the Mackie Huey itself, the thing that started it all, pretty much one of the first supported yep. control surfaces. That had plug-in support on it. There were a number of them. There were even the JL Cooper, whatever it was, MCS. I'm tempted to say MCS. I can't remember what the letters were, but it was like the something 10, you know, and it was like, not even moving faders, but yeah. just
CS10,
you know,
or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. CS10. Yeah, I think that bigger one was like the MCS10, like motorized control surface. Maybe that's what it stood for. The MCS3400. The plug-in thing was also a big consideration for me because I needed to be able to have my EQ and compressor and stuff like that. Again, coming from an analog world where I was used to, you know, patching stuff. Oh, well, having dedicated EQ on each channel, but patching compressors in line, that was really important to me. And of course the Control 24 has the dedicated, you know, dynamics and, you know, the buttons, you know, EQ and compression. So it's really such a no-brainer to be able to get into those and use them. And it got to a point where I knew the plugins well enough and I was comfortable enough that if I instantiated an EQ plugin, I would pretty much almost invariably do that on the first insert, you know, just right across the board. I just put EQ on everything, whether I'm going to use it or not. It's there, it's available to me. And it got to the point where I was able to just hit the EQ button on any given channel and know that the fourth knob was going to be the boost cut on the high shelf, that the fifth knob was going to be the, you know, the frequency range. And I didn't even have to use fader flip for EQ and compression. That I could just get away with using the knobs for that.
Right.
But other plugins, it got more complex, or stuff that I didn't use quite as much, like, let's say, a delay plugin. Well, I could never remember, you know, like you suddenly get those plugins going across all the, you know, three banks of knobs, and you're like, oh, wait a second, like the B4, the Native Instruments B4 plugin, my gosh, it's like four pages of 24 parameters, and like, there's no way that I would remember. So what I would do is I'd get into that plugin, get into fader flip mode, then I would page over. And then, like, sort of, I could recognize by the topography of the faders, the way they were positioned, that, yep, this is the third page of knobs. Here are my drawbars, you know. And it might take a little bit of refreshing my memory. I mean, I might sort of, like, move the drawbars and then make sure that I knew which one was the first one. And then I would count, say, from the 24th fader backwards and say, ah, okay, so it's fader number 17 starts the bank of drawbars, and then I might just, you know, flip up one preset with the up arrow and then flip back down to that previous preset and then sort of make my adjustments as necessary, you know, automated if necessary, of course, that kind of stuff. So there's certain techniques that, you know, a lot of it I know is certainly kind of crude in terms of just memorization or trial and error, but sometimes that's just the best way to do it.
Yeah,
sometimes
it's your gear, it's your setup, you learn your way around it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that for some people the way to go, and I certainly do this in some case, well, in many cases, any kind of gear that I have coming into the studio, I absolutely do a text document with, you know, the front panel layout, the rear panel layout, just a simple text document that says, okay, on the back you have, you know, 8 XLR, female XLR jacks, you know, from left to right they are 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then there's blah blah blah, you know, just to identify everything so that, you know, at some point, you know, I'm not going to use some piece of gear, you know, some compressor. I'm not going to use it for a couple of months, you know, and then there's going to come a project where I go, oh gosh, I can't remember what this is. I bring up that text document, refresh my memory, okay, good, you know, and then I'm rolling. Sometimes that's the better way to go, rather than just spinning knobs and trying to understand, you know, because some pieces of gear they're very there's some pieces of gear that you use all the time and you just know, but there are some that, you know, you might not have touched for weeks or months, and then, you know, you come back to it, and the best way is to go off your written notes. You know, and that said, on the Control 24, what I ended up doing also was I used these what they call lock dots, LOC dots, which are just basically locator dots. They're just clear plastic, round, you know, plastic dots that have a little raised kind of nub in the center, kind of like you would find on a number 5 key on a numeric keypad or a phone pad, you know. Just to call out certain key buttons, because the Control 24 has, you know, a couple of hundred buttons on it. And so, like, it's important to me, for example, to quickly be able to locate the solo off, you know, solo safe is to me not as important as just solo off. So I put a little raised dot on that knob so I could very easily find it. I started learning Braille, maybe 10 years ago or so. And that to me was a huge difference. I should have done this, you know, early on. I wish I had. But alas, you know, it's one of those things again, you know, I could use a magnifier and I'm fine. But, you know, as years go on, you start to realize that you can't read anymore. So how do I identify cables? You know, I would have, for a couple of years, I had to rely on other people. If I had to disconnect, you know, my noise reduction units, and there were hundreds of cables there, you know, you have your inputs and outputs from the console to the machine, back from the machine, back to the console. And, you know, I couldn't do it myself because it was purely a visual thing. You had to look at the color of the cable. You had to see whether it was solid or striped. Even sighted people would look at a yellow striped cable and go, I can't tell if this is striped or not. You know, one of those things. And then, you know, when I did start learning Braille, it was really as if somebody had turned on the light. I'm trying to see somebody's Washington State. I don't know who's calling me from there. Okay, well, anyway, that's my cell phone, though. Sorry. I started learning Braille, and then I came up with a system where I could label a cable with the Dymo tape. You know, I don't know if you remember sort of Dymo tape where it like embosses,
right, the,
kind of like a raised letter.
Like before the pre-touch, the P-touch.
P-touch, I'm not sure what
those that is. Brother labeling machines.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Right, exactly. Yeah, it would raise the letter and it would kind of make it a lighter color, and, you know. So there's a Braille version that's been around for many years. Well, I came up with a little system where I could take these aluminum tags, these kind of like dog tags, that had two, you know, a hole on either end, and I used little nylon tie wraps, and I would you know, type out the number on the dymo tape, affix that to the tag, and then affix that to the cable. I could tell the orientation, whether it was right side up or upside down, so I could easily identify that. And I started doing that for all my cables, and my gosh, it was like my world changed. If I needed to plug something in or identify something, I could do it completely independently, and I could do it any time, and that was a huge thing for me. So having learned Braille, I started even doing stuff like there's a magnetic version of dymo tape, and so I started putting like little magnetic strips right on the Control 24, because there are some dedicated buttons on there that I would never remember because I rarely use them, but boy, you know, if I need them and I just want to press a button rather than racking my brain trying to think, oh, what is the keyboard shortcut for that? You know, I could just reach over, now identify the button because there's a little Braille label above it, and just, you know, and just hit that key and I'm off. You know, again, that was a huge thing for me when the time came when I did take the time to do that. But so things were really looking great there for a while, getting to the Pro Tools petition thing. They were really great. And then OS X came out.
Uh-oh.
And OS X was... Yeah, and by the way, you know, the whole Windows side of things, where accessibility was a whole different story. You know, there were people on the Pro Tool, on the Windows side using Sonar, and there's different screen reader entirely on the Windows side of things. And I just never ever liked Windows. I couldn't even bring myself to think of doing something on a Windows computer, with all of the horror stories that surrounded me, you know, with people that I knew. Everybody in the recording industry was Mac. You know, it was like, yep, not even a consideration. The problem was that when OS X came out, the screen reader, Outspoken, did not work in OS X because it was really their sort of classic mode, which we thought, oh, well, we could just run in classic mode. That did not work, because classic mode was nothing more than OS X emulating OS 9, not even emulating, just disguising itself graphically as classic mode, pretty much. So the screen reader did not work. And the developer, Alpha Access Group, was working on a new screen reader. They had to rewrite it. And they did, and they got to a point where there were certain things that it could not read, and they needed some code from Apple, and Apple wouldn't share it, because what they were asking for was sort of getting too close to the kernel of the OS. And I guess Apple's thought was, well, first of all, there's some speculation now in hindsight, who knows, you know, whether Apple was already working on their screen reader and just basically didn't want anyone else to come up with something. But the other thought was that Apple was certainly confident that its system was secure, and that generally people would not be able to really hack into OS X, but people could almost assuredly hack into a screen reader. And if that screen reader was close to the kernel of the operating system, you could gain access to things that way. So that was the sort of speculation.
When OS X came out, did it include VoiceOver, or is that the screen reader that came along later?
It did not include VoiceOver. No, it didn't. It OS X came out in I'm tempted to say it was 2000.
It's early 2000 somewhere.
Maybe it was 1999, but I think it was it could have been even 1999, but when it did come out, there was no screen reader. There was an enlarging program, but at that point, I could not go back. I could not go back. From after using the screen reader and seeing how efficient it was, I could never go back to just trying to enlarge the screen. It was out of the question. So, it wasn't until I think around 2004 or 5, I mean, several years had gone by. Now, mind you, OS9 was still alive and well in 2002 and 2003 even, really. I mean, it was still, the end of 2002, G4 machines were still shipping with OS9 as a second operating system. So it wasn't like we were so concerned, because we figured, all right, well, you know, OS9 is still around here. And even after they stopped shipping OS9, a lot of studios were still on OS9. They didn't make a jump. Pro Tools wasn't even compatible with OS10 until like 2004, you know. But we started getting really concerned, because we were seeing that things were going to be moving ahead, and then suddenly Pro Tools did come out for OS 10. And so there was like no word on what was going to happen. Well, then finally, whatever it was, 2004 or whatever, Apple announced something called Spoken Interface. And I got onto the beta for that. I don't know how they found my name, or I really don't know whether it was previous Outspoken customers that they somehow got a hold of. I'm not sure, but they got me. Maybe it was original Outspoken beta testers. I have no idea, but somehow I got on that team, and it was really weird. It was a whole different way of navigating, a whole different concept. A lot of people were very lost, the beta testers, that is. We went through a confusing beta cycle, didn't get much in the way of feedback. We were kind of just like thrown in the water with this screen reader without any real documentation, and we were like kind of stumbling around with it.
Were you trying it with Pro Tools or just as a screen reader?
No, just simply with, just to try and get a hold of how to use the screen reader. I didn't even try it with Pro Tools at first.
Probably didn't even put it on your Pro Tools machine.
If
it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I could not afford to. Yeah. With the next, with each beta cycle, things seemed to get a little bit better, and they started to make more sense. And then, there was an email list for the beta testers and stuff, and people were kind of sharing hints and tips and stuff like that. And there was this just kind of tipping point where suddenly a lot of people just seemed to get it and thought, oh, okay, well, if you do this and you do it this way, that this seems to make sense. And it was like, for a lot of people, it just clicked. And with the within two seeds, within two versions, they pretty much had the screen reader, the first version of it done. And so then they introduced it as VoiceOver. They changed the name to VoiceOver. And it was the first version of it, which was available in Tiger, and that was like already there was Panther, Jaguar, and Cheetah. So this was the fourth, fourth
10.4.
Version of OS 10. Yeah, at least. So when Tiger came out, I got a laptop at that point. I got like an iBook or something, and I installed it, and it was great to be able to actually just buy a laptop with Tiger and just have it there. And I could just hit Command F5 and it just brought up the screen reader. So it was very exciting to have access, like, to the whole operating system. And, well, you know, there were things that were missing. iTunes was not accessible. I mean, you could get around by moving to, you know, within the Finder, finding a file, and then, you know, bringing up a contextual menu and saying open with iTunes. You know, it would automatically start playing. But that's a very backdoor way. It just doesn't – it's really not true accessibility, you know. So And we didn't know what was going to happen with that, you know, like the next version of the operating system, it still was not accessible. I mean, this is like, you know, 2 years later, we still don't have access to iTunes. A lot of people were, you know, kind of like confused about that and wondering why is this, you know? Well, it's a long story, and I don't even know the full story, but the point is, at a certain point, out of nowhere, like no announcement or whatever, it was just like, boom, iTunes was completely accessible. It was a bizarre thing. I'm sure it had something to do with the base code of iTunes. I think it was written in some kind of cross-platform, language so that it was compatible with Windows as well, and they had to reverse engineer some stuff, whatever. Anyway, at a certain point, I installed Pro Tools. I purposely went out and got like an LE system that I could use, like a 002 or something, a used 002 system. And I installed it on that system, and I launched Pro Tools. I was able to install it without any problem, really. But, you know, got into Pro Tools, and I, like, you know, first thing that opens up is a mix window, you know. And I get into mix window, and all it says is scroll area, scroll area, scroll area, scroll area. Well, I wasn't alarmed at first, because sometimes when you see something like that, you have to interact with it. That's their concept that they sort of came up with, was this hierarchy of working, so that if you encountered a window and then it had like maybe two major groups to it, you know, depending on the relationship of child window to parent window, you might encounter something that says scroll area. Well, then if you perform a particular keystroke, which was like control option shift down arrow, that would sort of interact with that item. And then within that scroll area, you might have all kinds of tables and buttons and whatever, checkboxes, whatever it was. So I tried interacting, nothing. I get an error beep. So, man, I couldn't believe it. It was just not accessible. In other words, DigiDesign had not written the code in such a way to really follow Apple's programming guidelines. So,
wow.
I told the other guys, you know, they were all, oh my gosh, you know, we got to talk to DigiDesign about this, you know. And at some point, I know Rick was the first one to get the stuff rolling with DigiDesign. He spoke with somebody there, and, well, they kind of said, oh, well, gee, you know, it worked before, and now it doesn't work. Geez, we must have done something to break that accessibility. You know, we should fix it. But there was never anything, like, committed to. Nothing was ever done. Finally, after repeated phone calls or whatever, we just said, you know, we got to do something. We got to do a petition, you know. So maybe that'll get some attention, you know. So we did that. We went through the process of, you know, this petition. We got some like 1,200 signatures or whatever. And we had scheduled a trip to go. Oh, in fact, I shouldn't even put it that way. We were contacted by DigiDesign because they got wind of the petition. And they said, hey, why don't you come out to Daly City and we'll talk about this. So I brought my laptop. I said, hey, do you have a 002 there that I can use? And they said, sure. Rick never made it. At the last minute, he just, I don't know what happened. He just didn't make it. But I went. And so we sat there, me and the vice president of marketing for Pro Tools and the vice president of Pro Tools product itself, and one of the guys from the development team, one of the programmers, and we had two systems side by side. I plugged in the 002, I launched Pro Tools, and I showed them how I got around under OS 9 and you know, this is how I would, you know, I use a lot of Pro Tools shortcuts, of course. If I want to create a track, I hit Command Shift N. You know, it just brings up that dialogue. I don't even have to read that dialogue. I know if I want to create three stereo tracks, I type three and hit Command Right Arrow. It's a shortcut for changing from mono to stereo.
Yeah,
and if I want, you know, auxiliary tracks instead, I hit the command down arrow. Yeah.
I do the same thing. And
yeah.
Because
yeah.
I've done it so many times, you just know
so many
those.
Times, right. And a lot of people, you know, power users always use keyboard shortcuts instead of reaching for the mouse. If they can, you know, if there's no other way, of course you use the mouse. But, you know, if there is a keyboard shortcut and you know, that's the way to go for a lot of people. So, yeah, I'm showing them around. I'm flying around Pro Tools and they're like, you know, oh wow, that's great! Wow, you know, and they're hearing a screen reader for the first time, so to them it's just even amazing that I could understand it, because a lot of, you know, screen reader users, they tend to use screen readers at a high speed, and so the screen reader to them sounds like it just sounds like mumbo jumbo. It doesn't even sound like anything, but I understand it perfectly.
I've listened to a few users mm-hmm. screen readers, and it's crazy, and I've tried it.
Yeah, no, right
at a much slower pace.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you first start out, I mean, you know, for new users, I mean, sometimes, yeah, they do start at a slower rate, but then they find that, you know, it gets too slow for them. They want to move faster, so they start increasing little by little, increasing speed. And at a certain point, you know, people just max, with Outspoken, a lot of people just max out the speed. It just went from 1 to 10 or 1 to 9 or whatever. Yeah, it was a zero rate also. That's, you know, zero rate. That's how it sounded, you know. It went from 0 to 9. And, you know, just at a certain point, you know, you reach 9 and that's your ceiling, and you just always used it at the fastest speed. But for most people, you did not understand it. Anyway, so
you had OS 9 running with Outspoken.
Yeah.
Your normal setup. And then you had OS 10.
Yep. And so then they had an OS 10 system right next to it. You know, we launched VoiceOver because it was built in, and I could get into the menu bar. You know, the menu bar was visible. It said, you know, it said Apple menu. It said Pro Tools, File, Edit, View, whatever, like all those display options, setups, et cetera, et cetera. But nothing. They'll scroll. I showed them the scroll areas. I say, you see, I bring up the edit window. I hit Command equals, you know, brings up the edit window. Scroll area, and now we get into the mix window, and I go, now there's an underlying framework. So there, so VoiceOver uses Apple's frameworks to know what is there. So if there's a radio button and that framework is used in the programming, VoiceOver sees it and just knows that it's a radio button and whether it's on or off. But if you have some kind of custom images or whatever, and you don't define that as being a radio button, VoiceOver has no idea what it is. It in some cases just won't even see it as an element, even just won't even see it. Well, I asked David to click on one of the inserts. Now suddenly VoiceOver is very chatty, says you know, pop-up menu, no insert, you know, and then, like, you know, he just like moves the mouse down, the physical mouse, you know, and says, you know, interface, submenu. Like, it could see all that, but one could not even navigate to that insert with VoiceOver because it did not even recognize that as a button of any sort, you know, as a control of any sort. And essentially what it is a pop-up menu is
right.
What it is. So he saw, you know, I mean, you know, I think that they were a bit... Well, I think that they were impressed with what was possible under OS 9 and how a blind user could use Pro Tools. And they said, well, you know, we see, you know, that there's this big problem here and stuff like that, and we would like to do something about it. We have to understand how it is that we could do this. And, you know, by the way, Pro Tools is a cross-platform program, so it's not like we built it from the ground up for the Mac. It is the same code for both Mac and Windows. And so then, you know, once that code is written, then it's drawn using, at that point it was, I can't remember what it was at that point, Quick Draw 3D or something like that. They mm-hmm. were changing over at that point to Quartz Extreme. And so then the actual user interface is drawn on the Mac side, and so sort of like the programming has to happen at that stage, or that, you know, the sort of, you know, all of those calling out of controls has to happen after the original code is written and stuff like that. So anyway, they said, well, we're going to see what we can do. And we stayed in touch, and, you know, there was no progress for a long time. And if you saw the petition site, I think you'll see that at a certain point, probably about a year and a half later, almost 2 years later or something like that, suddenly, out of nowhere, I get this, you know, message from the vice president of marketing, David Gibbons, saying, "Hey, listen, we've identified, you know, we know what's go-" Well, I should say earlier on, they said we kind of understand what's going on, but we can't do anything about it yet, and we're making this big transition of something. They kept in touch and they kept us posted, but at a certain point, I get this email from saying that, you know, we have this intern who's going to be working on, and he's already begun to work on the interface, and he might have something for you to take a look at, blah blah blah. And I volunteered to just go out there and meet with the guy and like sit down with him and do whatever is necessary. At a certain point, I did do that, and by that point, the intern, whose name was Chung, this Chinese guy, had been working on it for maybe two and a half, maybe not even 3 weeks. And I'm telling you, it was my jaw dropped when I was there, because, like, you know, we went from having no access to suddenly in the mix window seeing all these things that are all labeled already and they're all recognized, and here's the, you know, track input assignment pop up button, and everything was visible. And in the edit window, you had your controls grouped, like, you know, editor mode cluster. You had your counter display cluster of controls. You know, you could navigate through this stuff, tab to transients. I mean, all these buttons that were never quite visible, you had to kind of do little screen marker things. You had to jump through a few hoops under right. OS 9 to get to some of these things. And, I'm sitting there and I was practically in tears, because I thought, oh my gosh, this is great. This is incredible. This is what we've been waiting for years. And here it was happening, like, within the span of just a couple of weeks. Well, you know, I mean, I was so excited, and Sean worked on it for another week or something like that. He was only, you know, he was an intern, so he wasn't there for, you know, he was leaving a month later or whatever. You know, I got a beta version of Pro Tools, you know, so I could work with it back at my place. I submitted some, you know, things that needed changes. I mean, there were still things that still needed to happen. The MIDI event list was not accessible. I mean, we didn't see anything in the table. So the same thing like the mix and the edit window, where, you know, you get to this area, it just says scroll area, and you don't see anything inside of it. But there was a challenge. There's the way the program was written. You know, that was still a carbon window. It was not Cocoa.
Right.
So there was that issue. And they said, well, if it's going to be rewritten in Cocoa, you know, why don't we wait until then, and this and that. Well, of course, the MIDI event list still to this day is not accessible. And I don't know whether it's Cocoa now. I have no idea. But the point is, David Gibbons, the vice president of marketing, who was really the champion of this, he left the company. And the guy who was sort of his boss, whatever, has taken over. And he's a nice guy and all, but he's notorious about not getting back to people, especially if it's low priority. And I think, frankly, the accessibility of Pro Tools, it is a low priority item. And now, you know, we've had essentially the exact same level of accessibility that we saw in Pro Tools 8.0.4. Now we're on 10, you know, and, you know, this is several versions, you know, at least several versions in terms of updates, and no change, you know, and I recently spoke with David Gibbons. He's sort of looking around for a different job. He's been out of work for a while. I don't know if it was on purpose or whether he's been having a tough time. I'm not sure. But I spoke with him the other day and said, "Hey, listen, Bobby Lombardi, the sort of like essentially the guy in charge of Pro Tools. Now it's just not getting back to me. I've sent him multiple emails, just no response." He says, "Well, he's notorious about that. Lay a little guilt trip on him and see if he gets, give him another week, see if he gets back to you. If he doesn't, let me know." And at this point, I'm just giving it another few more days before I give David a call back to see if he can sort of maybe intervene. Although I hate to ask somebody from outside the company to have anything to do with this. But it's getting to the point where I feel like we have to do another petition or something, because this is ridiculous. I mean,
yeah, it seems like you had such encouraging improvement and then it stopped.
Yeah, I mean, and I understand completely that. Look, Shang's work that he did over the course of, let's say, a month. I mean, it took us 80% of the way there, and I'm not expecting that we get the other 20% in one shot, but my goodness, at least something like give us access to the MIDI event list. Just something that maybe once a year that we get like two features that we've been waiting for, just so that we can move forward. Because, you wouldn't believe, like, this, suddenly there was this community of blind users who were like jumping ship from Sonar, from Windows even, onto the Mac, and and buying Pro Tools and saying, "Wow, this is fantastic. It's so stable and there's no viruses and it sounds great. But what about the MIDI editor?" It's like, well, listen, guys, this is the deal. This is something that the company themselves is providing. It's not, you see, on the Windows side of things, people are used to a very different model. They're used to Windows. They're used to Microsoft. They're used to the developer of Sonar, and then you have the screen reader developer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually the screen reader developer that is the real liaison and problem solver. They have to come up with ways to write scripts for the screen reader to perform a certain action or recognize a certain control or whatever. And of course, you pay a premium for that. The screen reader, first of all, costs $1,500, and then you have to update at least once a year for about maybe $300 a year.
Wow.
So these people have paid thousands over the course of 10, 15 years of working with Sonar, or let's say 10 years. It's been longer, but they've spent thousands of dollars, and some of the results are good, but some results are not that great, and you have Sonar changing everything suddenly, and so now even all the Windows users just have no accessibility to the current version of Sonar, and for the foreseeable future too. That's why a lot of them kind of came over and said, "Hey, I'm just going to buy a Mac and have a built-in screen reader." And now that Pro Tools is accessible, well, at least for the most part,
largely,
that's what I'm going to use. But a lot of these guys are musicians; they're not audio engineers, and so what's important to them is the MIDI stuff. MIDI stuff is not important to me as an audio engineer. Most people that come to me, they're not using MIDI. They're either playing live instruments, or they've got all their keyboards done, or they might come to me with some kind of tracks and they want to overdub some acoustic instruments or whatever. So to me, it's not a deal breaker. But still, I mean, it's not like we can't use MIDI. We can certainly create a MIDI track, assign it, record enable it, cut, copy, paste, scrub. You can do all that kind of stuff. It's just the minute editing, the sort of double clicking on a velocity and just typing in a value. You can't do that right now.
Okay.
So, so Jeff, I'm afraid I've just babbled on and on about
It's great to hear that
and stuff like that. But
it's great to hear everything, and you. So basically, once Jean finished his work, nothing else has happened since then?
Nothing else has happened in terms of accessibility. We have the exact same level as we did in... now I'm having trouble remembering. I think it might be on the site. was it like fall of 2010 or something?
Pro Tools petition said fall 2009.
2009.
Yeah.
So it's not 3 years yet, but in a few months it's going to be 3 years. You know, so that's like, that's a long time. And you know what? Again, if we saw some result right now, that would still be great, because see, on the Windows side of things, whenever something changed, accessibility often just became broken. And so like if Sonar changed something about their interface or just even the position of things, it could really throw a wrench in the gears. Whereas now, you know, we've gone through a few versions of Pro Tools, I mean, three major versions between 8 and 9, well, two major versions, from 8 to 9 and 9 to 10, and meanwhile, nothing is broken. So we really had so much to gain, and this is why we decided also to pursue specifically Macintosh and voiceover accessibility, because it was we knew that for the most part professionals were using Mac with Pro Tools, and secondly, one didn't have to worry about scripts for the screen reader that if DigiDesign or now Avid changed something, that suddenly we'd be scrambling, you know, for something having to do with accessibility. I mean, now it doesn't matter whether they change the color of a control or even the appearance, since the underlying framework says this is a pop-up button, VoiceOver will always see it as a pop-up button, no matter what it looks like. So the good thing is that it's stable moving forward. And it's, I should say, persistent, you know, moving forward in terms of accessibility. So if we gain something, you know, we gain it pretty much for good. You know, at least that's the way it appears now. The track, you know, the record shows that.
Yeah.
How
about the region bin? Is that accessible?
Yes, it is, in the sense that, you know, it does appear as a region list, you know, and if you interact with it, you could read down that list. I think that there might be certain things that might not be visible in terms of all columns being read, but if you're looking for the basic name of something and you want to bring up maybe a contextual menu for it and whatever, that's doable. I think that list, given the number of items that could be in that list, like for example, if you look at that list and let's say you have your window maximized in a way that let's say it takes up from top to bottom say half the screen, okay, you might see, I don't know, 30 or 40 items in that list, but the reality is you could have hundreds, if not thousands, of regions.
Sure.
If you're in a big session, and you don't see them, and so as you're scrolling, you know, that's when the system seems to, you know, draw that information in and stuff and scroll that information. But with the screen reader, it sees everything, even though it's not visible to you. So the truth is, if you get into a session where you have hundreds and hundreds of regions, it gets a little bit sluggish when you get into that list, because like the system will not be responsive for, you know, depending on the size, you know, anywhere from a couple of seconds to maybe 15 seconds, you know, something like that. To me, it seems like an eternity.
Well, it compiles that list.
Yes, exactly. So that it has this virtual list that, you know, if you were to just, you know, want to get to a particular region and you happen to know the name, you could start typing the first letters of it and, you know, it comes up. I mean, yeah, the other way to work, of course, is to try and keep that list clear. You know, if you just want to, you know, you might choose to only find certain regions and only display certain regions and stuff like that. So you kind of get around that. I must say, for a blind user, the regions list is not, It's not accessed all that much, to tell you the truth. I know that, for example, you know, a sighted user would maybe find a region in there and drag it out to a track or something like that.
Right.
That is not really practical for a blind user to do. If I have to get a region into a track, you know, a bit of audio into track, I would usually import it to a track, and it would show up right at the top of a new track. Now that's not to say that I haven't needed to route, you know, a region, say, to the tail end of something, you know, and there are certain keyboard shortcuts. Again, you know, if you control drag something, whatever, it'll snap to the insertion point and stuff like that. And this is where stuff like the mouse, physical mouse, becomes more handy in OS X. The fact that VoiceOver currently does not support command click or modifier clicking with VoiceOver. You can do a mouse click with VoiceOver. You know, it's the control and option keys with shift modifier and a space bar. That's a physical mouse click. But that doesn't really, really work with Pro Tools. You know, if you had to do, let's say, for example, you wanted to option click on a solo button, or mm-hmm. a record button to record enable everything.
Right.
You can't do it with VoiceOver because you're already using the option key as a modifier for VoiceOver itself. So the fact that VoiceOver doesn't support modified mouse clicks is a bit of a problem. So you have to actually route the mouse pointer itself to that control. So I navigate to, let's say, a record button and route the mouse key, you know, the mouse pointer to that key, and then I literally click a mouse while holding down the option key. And that's fine. I mean, it's
an actual physical mouse.
Yes. Gotcha. Or a trackpad.
Right.
Yeah, some people like the Magic Trackpad, of course, because if you're in a big session, you know, you want to get over to track 23 to 33, if you physically touch that trackpad over on the right side, VoiceOver will right away find that track. It'll tell you that you're on that track that you're looking for, rather than using the sort of typical navigation of like using the VoiceOver keys to go to the right in the mix window. And, you know, you're going one track at a time, kick, snare, tom, low tom, high tom, whatever. You know, instead of doing that the long way, you just touch a trackpad and you're there, you know. So so that's why nowadays the mouse is a little bit more important, or at least the trackpad is a little more important, yeah. Well, I should say it's a lot more important. The other thing that is also very important is a numeric keypad, because the way it's a combination of the way it's programmed, but the way Xiong sort of revealed these controls and did it the best he could was that you can't, with VoiceOver, you can't interact with the counter display to sort of like double click on it and change a value. Like, you know, if you had your edit window open and you wanted to get to, 23 minutes and 45 seconds, I suppose you could take your mouse and double click on the minutes field,
yep,
and then hit a decimal and then 45 or whatever. The way a blind user would do it was that you would, from the numeric keypad, press the asterisk key and then hit 2, 3, decimal 4, 5 and enter. If you wanted to, you knew you wanted to select from the 15 minute mark to the 19 minute mark, you would press the slash key, you know, type 15 and then press the slash key again, and then type 19. So the slash key cycles between the start, edit, and length fields. Let's say you were somewhere uh-huh. where you knew that you wanted to select the next 2.5 seconds. You know, you'd hit the slash key 3 times, type 2.5, and then hit enter. You know, that's the way a blind user would get around that whole, you know, navigating in terms of time.
So when you're using a laptop, do you always hook a full external keyboard?
Always.
Have you found
an
external just keypad?
No, because, and this is what a lot of people wonder about. Now, two things. There are some key remap programs that supposedly, you know, you could hit some kind of, you know, whether it's the FN key, you know, to change so that, you know, your K key is the 5 key.
Yeah, that used to be on the laptops and they took it off.
They took it off right now, but there are apparently some third-party programs that supposedly do that. I downloaded one recently, but I have not tried it. That might work fine. I don't know. But the problem with the external numpads is that they don't support the modifier thing either. So let's say if you needed to do Command Numpad 1 to bring up the
transport
window. At least the numeric keypads that I've seen have all been Bluetooth external numpads. They haven't been USB or anything like that. So
yeah,
I don't know whether I'm sorry?
I think the Mac sees those as two different devices.
They see it as two different devices and somehow they just don't work together. There is, you know, I mean, of course, there's the Apple, you know, extended or the Pro keyboard, whatever they call, and that's fine. It's very low profile. It's $40 or whatever. It's great. That works best so far. Of course, there are some older wireless Apple keyboards, the sort of like thicker, you know, plastic keyboards that they had that still work well if you could find them. There are some wireless third-party I just totally blanked. Wireless third-party keyboards, QWERTY keyboards with numpad that I've come across. Can't remember the name. There's one in particular that was like, I don't know, maybe around $89 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and that works well. I mean, that works fine. It's a folding keyboard, in fact, so it is. You know, you could throw it in your backpack very easily. Although I find even the Apple Pro keyboard is
small
enough that it's actually I could fit into my laptop bag without any problem. But the numeric keypad is a must with Pro Tools. You can't otherwise get to a particular location. I had an emergency downtown when I was down in North Carolina, down south, I should say, where a client called me from out of town and they had an emergency. They had a show that they were doing the next day and there was a problem with the file that they had, you know, and I had to edit something and I had my laptop and I happened to have the file up on a Dropbox folder so I could download it. But I had no external keyboard with me. I didn't bring one with me. My wife and I were visiting family down there. They're Windows based. They didn't have any Macs. And I thought, gosh, how am I gonna do this editing? Now I could get into like shuttle mode. I always use the shuttle mode on the numeric keypad. I don't use the transport or the classic mode or whatever. I never use those. Shuttle mode is great for me because whatever track I'm in, you know, I could just go at high speed or low speed or backwards. Very, very quick for me. And then I realized, oh, wait a second. I could use my iPhone. So I downloaded the NumPad app. So I was able to use that. I didn't need to open anything like a transport window or anything like that. That didn't matter. All I needed it for was that slash key or the asterisk key.
Right. Yeah.
And it was great. It worked fantastic. I paired it up. It was no problem. It's a free app. And like, oh, it's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So.
When you, the voiceover output, the voice from the computer, do you run that through your studio monitors? Do you like to hear that from a different sort of speaker or place?
Yeah, I mean, I keep that separate. I in other words, the computer, if I'm running off a laptop, then it just comes out the laptop speakers. That's good enough if I'm doing something like that. If I'm working, you know, under any other circumstances, I would route it through a separate set of speakers that are just dedicated to the screen reader. That way, if I need to, I can. The monitors that I do use have a little headphone jack, so if I really want to keep that discreet for whatever reason, even if it's just, you know, so that I don't get any sort of possibility of leakage or something like that, or if there's a discussion in the control room between several people, and you know, I've certainly at times found myself turning up the screen reader louder and louder. At a certain point, it stops the conversation because people realize that they're, you know, that I can't hear what I'm doing sometimes. You know, if I'm doing some kind of editing or I need to refer to some information on screen, sometimes I get to the point where I'm turning it up, and that kind of, you know, I don't want to do that. I mean, I certainly don't want to interrupt people or anything like that. It's not intentional, but sometimes it just works out that way.
Right.
I try to keep a pair of little earbuds handy in case I know that these people need to have this conversation and I need to stay out of their way, but I also need to get my stuff done stealthily. You know.
When you went down and worked at that other studio, is that something you're comfortable with? What do you take with you? Do you need preference files? Do you need any special hardware?
Well, yeah, when I went down there, I mean, you know, that was one of those instances where it was so great. It was so great to be able to walk in there and just say, okay, so listen, I just need to get a little speaker in here so I can, you know, because their computer, of course, is in a machine room.
Mm-hmm.
I said, is there any way we just get a little speaker in here so I could hear the computer? And they said, yeah, sure. They went, they got a little powered speaker from somewhere and hooked it up, and they were running, I don't know, it was Pro Tools 9, I think it was 9, but it was like, it could have even been 804, I'm not even sure, but yeah, I just hit Command F5 and it came up. Now, I didn't have to run Pro Tools, I mean, I did, only because it was easier for me to do it. I mean, I didn't have to, I certainly could have had my assistant do it. I mean, the room basically came with an assistant engineer, which is sort of normal, of course, for, yep, you know, for an outside engineer to come in. You know, I could have had him do it, but it was just easier for me to just, you know, if I needed to stop or if I needed to talk to somebody or needed to whatever, you know, punch in a certain way, I didn't need to discuss that with him. I just handled it myself, and that was such a refreshing thing. I mean, before that, I would have to rely on somebody else to handle the transport. I do orchestral sessions sort of every, for this one particular producer, I've been doing it since like 1995. And I've
location recordings?
No, at studios, but okay. These I do overseas, typically in Ukraine. This particular producer does a lot of work with a particular composer who's in Kiev, and we would do these recordings at this film lot, Dovzhenko film lot. It's basically like the Disney lot, you know.
Gotcha.
They had they have these old buildings that were recording studios, sound stages. They used to do film scores there and stuff like that. So we worked there for a number of years, and then we moved to a different location, a purpose-built recording studio. It's like basically like essentially like a bigger version of Abbey Road, EMI Studios at Abbey Road in Ukraine. Just gorgeous, two huge orchestral studios, probably about 50 by 80 feet with like 40-foot ceilings, 35, 40-foot. It's just really extraordinary spaces.
Yeah, orchestral recordings, my love. So.
Yes, specifically for orchestral studios. Yes.
Yeah, that's my love. So.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Just awesome places. And the thing was with these places, the first studio, that was old. I mean, that was really, I mean, that was the Dovzhenko Film Studio was built, like the Odessa steps scenes were recorded there. We're talking, you know, 19... 10, you know, it's like old stuff. And like they had just old tape machines that just really didn't work, old consoles that didn't work. And we had to bring in rental equipment. We were recording to ADATs back then. You know, we actually brought in 3, you know, ADATs, a ton of tapes and stuff. And we were recording through like a Soundcraft Spirit console or something that was, you know, the best we could get our hands on that they had there that was working. And, but then when we moved over to this, this purpose-built orchestral studio, you know, they were using like a, you know, I think they were at that time using like a Cedar, system or something, or, not Cedar. What's the other one? The
Radar?
No. The British. It's not Sadie. Sadie. It's a Sadie system. But when we came in there, I really needed to use Pro Tools. So again, we were still bringing an HD system with us. You know, we were at one point we even brought a G4 with us, you know, just to, you know, and I had a Magma chassis that I was bringing. We were bringing a pair of 192s, you know, with, you know, 32 inputs and stuff. Well, finally, the last two times we were there, because we do this every other year, productions for them, you know, finally, the last time we were there, they had a Pro Tools system in there already. They had an HD system. So I don't have to lug quite as much equipment around. But I always used to have to rely on someone else to do stuff. And the funny thing is, it's funny the way things change. Back then, I was, you know, I was, when stuff was not accessible to me, I was, you know, especially, concerned, you know, with the systems and, you know, where we were, what, you know, how much time did we have? I mean, when we were dealing with tape or whatever, what the levels were, all that kind of stuff. And the funny thing is, you know, we got to the point and working in this new studio where it has a full staff of people and everything like that. It got to the point where, you know, as Pro Tools became accessible, I had to worry less and less about that kind of stuff, even though I could now, you know, have access to everything and be aware of everything myself. There was already an assistant doing that kind of stuff for me. So like now I could just worry about the big picture and not have to concern myself with the details, which are now accessible to me. It's just ironic how, you know, the tables turned, or the tables flipped in a way. The faders flipped.
There you go.
But, yeah.
So have you tried the accessibility things on the iPad? Played with?
My wife has an iPad. I have not played around with it. I have an iPhone, and I've certainly tried a couple of things. I've found that some things are mildly accessible. I haven't found anything that blew me away, like GarageBand, for example. You know, GarageBand on the iPhone, okay, I could call up a piano and sort of play a little bit of piano on there, but it's, to me, it's not very practical. I have not tried any of the Control Surface kind of emulation things, or Control Surface apps. I should, I really should, and I should just commandeer my wife's iPad, which she barely uses anyway, and try to investigate some of that stuff. I have not yet, though. I am hoping that, you know, that the stuff is accessible, and you know, I think it's an environment where if you're programming it, it's more difficult to make it inaccessible than it is to make it accessible, you know. So I'm hopeful.
Awesome. Well, I think that's about the questions I have for you now. This has been very, very helpful. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure, Jeff. Anytime.
All right. Well, you got my email. You know where to find me.
Sounds good.
Well, it's been,
righty,
it's been great talking with you.
And anything I can do to help is anytime.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.